Now, here's a puzzle requiring some lateral thinking. How would you control parking without parking meters, leaving it to drivers with just one absolute requirement? Answer, insist they leave their lights on. This was the brainchild of Edward de Bono of Malta. We heard from him last week. He died in June, but he lives once again in this conversation about his life from The Science Show in 1997.
I was always curious. I was always making inventions and trying things out. And in fact, when I was at school, there were two things that happened. One is I was the only boy with his own key to the chemistry laboratory, so I'd go in any time. Secondly, when I was at school, I was about 11, and this is a boarding school, I opened up an underground route through the shelters of the school, through the middle of a girls' school, the shelters, out into the town about half a mile away. I devised all the keys and the maps and so on. And the bigger boys, 16, 17, used to have to come and ask me for my maps and my keys and permission to use my escape route.
To get into the girls' school?
No. The girls' school was just on the way.
Ah.
No. I wouldn't be encouraging improper behaviour. No, to get into the town and go and have a beer.
I see. Well, when such a person got a place at Oxford,
yes,
to just about the most aristocratic college, Christchurch, yeah. Mm-hmm. Was that a confrontation, taking on
Not
the Brits at the high level?
Not at all. In fact, I was elected to be president of the Scottish Reeling Club, even though the place was full of genuine Scots lads and so on and so on, probably because I knew more pretty girls than anyone else did, and they wanted those girls to come and dance at the Scottish Reeling Club.
What was your secret then of fitting in such an alien place?
Simply not to start assuming that you're not going to fit in. I think expectations set a lot.
Were you reading psychology from the beginning?
I was reading, it was called PPP, which is psychology and physiology, and you can do philosophy if you want instead of physiology. So I was reading that. At that time, only 20, I think maybe 30 people in the whole of Oxford were allowed to read psychology, and it was very restricted there. Now it's much bigger. I enjoyed it. It was a little bit disappointing. There was a certain amount of emphasis on rats and mazes and so on rather than real people.
But very experimental.
Yes, it was actually called experimental psychology, yes.
You graduated, then what happened?
Well, I'd already done medicine in Malta. I was a doctor. And then I graduated. Then at the Radcliffe, I did a DPhil, which is the Oxford equivalent of PhD, in controlled blood pressure and systems behaviour and so on. Then I went to St. Thomas's Hospital. And then I went from there to Cambridge University to help with Professor Ivor Mills. We were starting the clinical unit there. And when I went, there were just two of us. When I left, there was a staff of 85. And then I went to Harvard for a while, then I came back to Cambridge and so on.
Only the most wonderful Ivy League places.
Well, it's happened that way.
And it seems so far to be a conventional rise through the ranks mm-hmm. of a medical doctor. When did lateral thinking come in there?
Well, you see, several things happened. From psychology, I was interested in thinking. Then the key thing was in medicine, I was dealing with the complex system behavior, circulation, respiration, sodium excretion, endocrinology, how all these things interacted. So I developed some concepts of self-organizing systems. Then in medicine, I was working with computers. This is way back, this is 1964, and the IBM, I think, was 7094 or something. But from medicine came the idea on self-organizing systems. So the key book was The Mechanism of Mind, which I wrote in 1969. Now, that book was rather ahead of its time. In fact, probably the leading physicist in the world, Professor Murray Gell-Mann at Caltech, read that book, and he said, it's interesting, you were talking about these things 10 years before mathematicians started looking at chaos theory, stable systems, unstable systems, and so on. So that was what I was talking about in my book. And that really was the basis for then saying, if I'm dealing with creativity, what is the underlying mechanism in the mind? Pattern forming, asymmetric pattern, the needs to cut across patterns, provocation, all these things. So that's how it all developed. Then I started writing about it. And then that part of society which showed the most interest was the business community. Because in business, you've got to think. In many other parts of society, political, even academic, it's enough to defend your point of view and prove you're right. In business, you can prove you're right till you're blue in the face and go bankrupt the next day. So there's a reality test. So business has always said, we need new ideas. What you're doing is of interest to us. Because if you read my first book, there's not a mention of business in it. And so then, obviously, I developed several strands, working with business, working in education, and also developing further ideas.
You've got a tremendous feel for metaphor. It yes. seems quite extraordinary, the rock logic and the water logic, the hats, the very term lateral thinking. Mm-hmm. Is that the key to it?
Well, you see, indirectly in what you say, yes, because I'm dealing with the perception side of thinking. Now, traditionally, we've always put emphasis on the processing side of thinking, mathematics, logic, and so on. The perceptual side of thinking is extremely important, but we've always neglected it. And yet, in real life, and Professor David Perkins at Harvard has done research, which he says supports what I've always maintained, 90% of the mistakes of thinking are mistakes of perception, not of logic. Now, if you're dealing with perception, you've got to deal with it in a different way. And if you want to illustrate a relationship or possibility, then a metaphor is the way to do it.
Back to business. Apart from the money, which, of course, business is prepared to pay, do you find it not frustrating having to do essentially a party piece for the next hotel full of people in power suits rather than exchanging ideas in the old academic way with your peers?
Well, the answer is no, because, you see, the more you talk and you find simpler, better ways of explaining something, you clarify things for yourself. And there's always a certain amount of interaction. I mean, for instance, far more interesting for me to be working with one particular corporation or something, because you get to find out what's happening in that business, the processes and so on. And of course, I also do a lot in education. And I've just been in Singapore, a big conference on teaching thinking, which started in 1982. There was a young American teacher in Fiji who was using my work in schools, started this thinking conference, and now it's huge. There were 2,200 people, 350 presenters, and so on. But a lot of the stuff was incredibly old-fashioned. I mean, you know, this type of person, type A, type B, type C. And I always say, I'm in the business of designing bicycles. In other words, if you're a fat man and a thin man, you run a race, sure, the thin man will often beat the fat man. You put them both on bicycles, it's totally different. In other words, we are obsessed with what is, not with what can be. The difference between analysis and truth and design. Design is how we move forward from what is to bring about what can be. And a lot of our thinking, the Western traditions of thinking, are again overly obsessed with what is, yes. not with what can be.
Well, talking about what can be, there's great yes. criticism of business these days in Australia, mm-hmm. in Britain to some extent, and in America, mm-hmm. where various writers such as John Ralston Saul, whose book yeah. Unconscious Civilization, mm-hmm. talks about the new manager being unbelievably narrow-minded, saying we must produce a very efficient firm whose criteria would be the bottom line, rather than the future, its place in the community and such like. If this is so, would it be perhaps that your influence hasn't been as extensive as it might have been?
No, I think that's not true. You see, I think that view is a little old-fashioned. Over the last 10 to 15 years, the emphasis has been on what I call housekeeping. Efficiency, cost-cutting, downsizing. It's beginning to change now because people in business are coming to realize that competence is becoming a commodity. It's not enough. Value creation is what matters. Now, having said that, to be fair, I think business has a lot of talent, and if the game is spelt out, business is prepared to do a lot for society. But there you need some sort of framework, like the one I'm going to suggest, where a government would say to business, okay, you owe us so much in tax, but you can use 30% of that for defined areas which we will set, whether it's education, whether it's housing, and you do that. Instead of paying it to us as government and then we will administer it, you do that. Use your talents and your resources to use that 30% of your what would otherwise be taxed to do something, and you'd get a huge change.
For the common good?
For the common good, absolutely.
Is that happening now? I mean,
no, it isn't happening, but you see, a certain amount of business does probably as much education almost as the tertiary system does once people enter business and so on. So the skill is there, the willingness is there, but it's a little unfair to business saying, look, you've got to satisfy your shareholders, you've got to survive, you've got to pay the taxes, and now we want you to be major sources of social change as well.
What about the politicians, their thinking?
Politicians have a very difficult job because they see themselves as driving a car. They don't choose the car, they don't choose the road, they don't choose the destination, but guiding the car along a bumpy road and keeping the car on the road. Generally speaking, politicians, and quite rightly, see initiatives as a huge danger because initiatives will not get you more friends but are very likely to get more enemies. So survival day to day, to and through the next election, is the game we have laid out for politicians to play, and we can hardly blame them if they play it.
What's the solution then?
There's a number of solutions. One of the solutions which I suggested as an improvement on democracy is that we'd have a certain number of seats in Parliament which would depend on the difference between the two main parties, these seats would not have anyone sitting in them. But when an issue came up, two types of issue, if it's a general issue, then opinion poll would vote those seats. So if 70% of people say we like this, 70% of those seats would vote. This means that the opposition could introduce legislation and get it through. If it was a technical matter, then those seats would be voted by a technical panel, which anyone could get access to, provided they passed, for instance, a simple test in economics and so on. And if 70% of that open panel said we like it, then 70% of the seats would vote. So this would be a continual partial interaction with the public, not just, well, wait for the next election and vote this way or vote that way.
Interesting. Yeah. Do you think it might happen?
Well, the answer is it won't happen in the sense that any governing party isn't going to want to change the rules to change it. But any newspaper could do it. Any newspaper could say, OK, we're going to create our notional 50 seats or whatever, and we'll do an opinion poll, and we will say if the system was operating, this would have been defeated. And once you get it happening, people get used to it, then it might happen.
You're obviously relishing these ideas. You've produced about 20 times as many as most people I talk to. Do you feel that they are being taken up?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples. Years ago, I suggested that we could have free public telephones because your conversation would be interrupted by an advertising message and advertisers would pay for your telephone call. Thought no more about it. Today, it's happening in Sweden, it's happening in Denmark, it's happening in Washington State, exactly as I predicted. 1970, I suggested to Shell Oil that instead of drilling oil wells straight down, they should drill them down and then move sideways. They did nothing about it. Today, almost every oil well in the world is drilled that way because you get between 3 and 6 times as much oil. So the ideas do come through from time to time.
And you're still finding it fun?
Oh, it's great fun, yes. Yeah.
Would you choose some music for us?
Yes. I've always liked the overture from The Flying Dutchman.
Music for gentle reflection? Well, no. Edward de Bono, lateral thinker, who died in June,